Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. As we gear up for award season, there's no better time to join us. By becoming a Vanity Fair subscriber, you'll gain exclusive access to our in-depth coverage of film, television, and the best of Hollywood. And that's just the beginning. Vanity Fair takes you inside the worlds of entertainment, culture, politics, and scandal, bringing you iconic images, era-defining stories, and much more. Get 15% off a year of digital access to Vanity Fair by visiting vanityfair.com and using promo code POD15 at checkout. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a full year of insights and exclusive digital access. Subscribe now.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I am Katie Rich, and I'm here with Richard Lawson.
Hello.
And Rebecca Ford.
Hi.
It is mid-July. It is right after the Emmy nominations, but we're going to talk about movies for a little bit because festival season is right around the corner. If you follow the Toronto Film Festival on Twitter, you've gotten used to their eyes emoji tweets, which follow their announcement of, so far not a full lineup, but a single title from their lineup. So we'll talk about that. The Venice Film Festival lineup is on the horizon, and we've got maybe a couple films we can look at as potentials. We also have new movies, Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris. You heard David talking to Leslie Manville about it last week. We'll talk about that and Where the Crawdads Sing. I am making everyone go back to Top Gun, the great box office success story of the summer, to talk about that a little bit in terms of awards. And then we have a few final Emmy things to get into, including your listener questions. So let's start with TIFF. As we record on Tuesday, the big announcement today was The Woman King, which if you've heard of, you might have heard of from Vanity Fair in the First Look piece that we ran. It joins Bros, the rom-com with Billy Eichner, Glass Onion, the Knives Out sequel, a Canadian film called Brother, and then a adaptation of a novel by Angie Thomas called On the Come Up, as the only titles we know of so far. Rebecca, does this all feel like what we would expect TIFF to have so far?
I think this is what we would expect TIFF to have this year. Last year was a little muted, and I'm really excited to have it back to form because TIFF is always such a great festival. And so far, like having a big splashy Knives Out premiere and now these more anticipated films like The Woman King, it does feel pretty promising.
Yeah, The Woman King, like Bros, had a September release date. So those of us who kind of spend our summer looking toward the fall, like I think would have guessed that either of them might show up, but it's nice to see them both on there.
I thought that Woman King might be opening night, but it sounds like maybe not. So, and usually that's not every year, but many years it's a big commercial film that's coming out shortly thereafter. So I would be curious to see if there's something that's not on our radar that could be filling that slot, or they might go with some sort of music doc, which they've done in the past, or maybe a Canadian film. But yeah, I mean, I think Woman King, we were all pretty certain, just given that it's out later in September, that would be a great place for it to debut. And similar with Bros. But yeah, those three films, I mean, that's a big starry lineup already. Mm-hmm. And those are all world premieres at Toronto. And Toronto has, year by year, I think, had a little trouble getting its own world premieres because Venice and Telluride are right before it, and they kind of snap up a lot of the award stuff. So I think it's a good return to form for the festival so far.
Yeah, I'm sure we've talked about this before, but Toronto, in terms of putting in a crowd pleaser, I think it is the place that you want to be. And that's not always the case. Like Joker, I don't know if Joker's a crowd pleaser, but Joker's a big commercial movie that premiered at Venice, so it's not always the case. But I think it's really smart for like movies like Bros and Glass Onion and, you know, possibly The Woman King, which seems a little bit more dramatic, but to like really have that populist spirit, which I think Toronto really excels at.
Yeah, it's interesting how they're announcing this lineup this year. It feels different. The rumor is the full lineup isn't going to come out till August, which is late. It's usually, I think, the end of July, and that they're going to keep doing these sort of one-off announcements, which I guess is a way to build anticipation, but not as easy for those of us trying to plan our festival coverage.
And I wonder if it's a way, you know, I think we all expected Toronto to come back in full force after two quiet years. But I wonder if slowly building is like, hey, you filmmaker who's not sure about going to Toronto, look at what we've got so far. Like they're kind of building the case for themselves by rolling it out slowly.
Yeah, I think one interesting facet of Toronto is I believe they are doing a virtual component as well, right?
Oh,
yeah, that was kind of announced. I don't know if they've like walked that back at all, but my hunch would be that a lot of the bigger films, studio films, whatever, aren't going to be on the virtual platform. So I think that's one thing that maybe festivals like Toronto had trouble with last year, maybe Sundance to some extent in 2020, is that like, or sorry, 2021, is like convincing distributors or producers or whoever that like, no, it's going to get the real festival thing or the virtual thing is just as good, et cetera, et cetera. I think that's probably been a lot of negotiation that the festivals do not talk about because they don't want to, obviously. I would think that this year's in-person Toronto will be significantly more robust than whatever they do online, but maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was a problem even last year with virtual Toronto. Like a lot of stuff wound up at New York Film Festival or in places where like there was a more substantial in-person component, which I don't blame them for. Like I remember seeing Nomadland in my basement during Toronto in 2020 and like being really grateful to see it, but it's not the same.
Yeah, and you know, last year there were people because Toronto didn't really communicate that well, you know, what was going to be available online versus in person. I went in person and I was one of like six people there. But it meant I got to see stuff that wasn't online. And then people at home were like, oh, no, I thought I could watch Dune. And it was like, you thought Warner Brothers was going to give you Dune?
They put it on HBO Max a month later.
That was never going to happen. But this feels a lot more clear cut thus far, which I think is good.
Yeah. Richard, you mentioned that the Venice lineup is expected. You are going to be in Venice for us as well. We don't really know anything, but are there other titles like coming up in the fall that you have your eye on as potential Venice options?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, the titles I keep hearing when Venice is brought up is Darren Aronofsky, who has The Whale with Brendan Fraser. Damien Chazelle has premiered his last two films at Venice. So I think First Man and La La Land, where Emma Stone won the Best Actress prize on her way to winning an Oscar. So I would think that Babylon would be there because it's big.
Even though that's a Christmas release, right? So it's coming a lot later.
It is a lot later, and that might mean that I'm wrong, but that's a name I just keep hearing brought up, as well as Luca Guadagnino with Bones and All, which we'll be talking about in, well, the book that it's based on next month.
Yeah. At the end of this episode, we can give the lineup for our book club in August.
Yeah.
Good reminder.
So, I don't know. I also hear like people wishful thinking about Ari Aster's film, Disappointments Boulevard, which we don't even know if it's done yet. But I would anticipate like a really big lineup. Noah Baumbach has the adaptation of the Don DeLillo novel, White Noise. It's kind of funny that a Noah Baumbach movie is called that.
It's the alternate title for Marriage Story, right?
Right. So I don't know. I'm anticipating big. The question there is always like, okay, so what does Venice get? What does Toronto get? What does Telluride share? And what does Telluride, which doesn't announce its lineup until the day the festival starts, what is that going to world premiere? Because they have some stuff that I think I could see, like She Said, being big at Telluride.
Yeah, I was going to note we got a trailer for that last week, I guess, which is a strong indicator that something is going to show up somewhere in the early fall.
There are certain movies that seem to kind of grab an American moment, a political moment that feel perfect for the Telluride audience, you know, and they can shine a little bit brighter, bigger because they're not trying to compete with all of the glamour and drama of Venice. So I don't know. I think She Said feels like that could be a strong debut at Telluride, but maybe it'll be at Venice too. I don't know.
I'm also curious which films try to do all the triple crown.
Yeah.
Which is always a sign that, you know, the studio's very, very hot on it. I think La La Land did and Shape of Water did, if I remember correctly.
Shape of Water did.
And obviously they went on to really big awards campaign, so.
In an upcoming issue of Vanity Fair, David, who's not here today, but we'll talk about him, wrote a piece about that sprint between Venice and Telluride and talked to Guillermo del Toro and Maggie Gyllenhaal both, who like went to Venice, premiered the movie, went to Telluride, then went back to Venice because they won a prize, which is just something people do every year. And if you get to do it, it means great things for your movie. So you're lucky to do that.
And it's an opportunity to see celebrities and publicists at the most tired they'll ever be. And they have no idea what time it is or where, what country they're in. And it's, I feel very, I mean, I knew a publicist once, one who we all know, I think, who went to Telluride, left, flew to Venice, flew back to Telluride, and then went to Toronto. And it's just like, how are you?
Where are you?
I couldn't, it's a lot.
Yeah. Back to She Said for a second, though, you speculating about me in Venice. I'm reading the book because it will also be in our book club. Again, stay tuned to the end for more. And there's a very, very pivotal scene set at the Venice Film Festival. So maybe that's enough to get it there.
Oh, yeah, that's a fair point. Although, does the Venice Film Festival want to remind people that they used to have
not,
certain...
Not their fault that Harvey Weinstein behaved despicably there. But yes, that's a fair. That's also fair. One other title I wanted to throw out that I haven't heard any buzz about it at all, but Searchlight Pictures sent out an email last week announcing a release date for Empire of Light, the Sam Mendes film with Olivia Colman and Colin Firth, set at a movie theater, which, I mean, if you want to look for Oscar buzz, that's where to go.
That was the bingo card, yeah.
Yeah, pretty much. Let me just read the log line. Set in an English seaside town in the early 1980s, Empire of Light is a powerful and poignant story about human connection and the magic of cinema. Ding, 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 ding. So anyway, that got set for a December 9th release date. I don't know if that means it'll be at a festival, but again, sending out a summer press release about your December movie like kind of sets my like the hairs in the back of my neck.
Yeah.
Rebecca, do you have anything you're speculating about at this point that you just hope might come up on a lineup?
You know, I'm also very interested in where I've been very hot on Babylon for a long time. And I think the Baumbach, I'm curious about where. I mean, I feel like it's inevitably at a festival. I just don't know where, which ones it's going to end up at.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The other one I wanted to throw out was the Martin McDonagh movie, Banshees of Inisherin. I got to work on that. Anyway, it's set for a fall release date. So, again, a Searchlight movie that I hope we can look for. And also Ticket to Paradise, the Julia Roberts, George Clooney comedy from Old Parker. It's set for an October release. I can see that movie at Toronto. If Rose is there, why not?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah.
I would probably like skip some acclaimed foreign release to go see that at Toronto. I can see that decision.
I believe that Toronto is a for-profit festival. And so I think that like selling tickets to that at the Princess of Wales Theater, like that would sell out probably. So,
well, and presumably like they need to bring people back after these last 2 years. So can't blame them.
Oh, I just remembered one thing. By the time this episode goes up, I'll have a first look on The Good Nurse, which stars two Oscar winners, Eddie Redmayne and Jessica Chastain. And so that film is a Netflix film, but I feel like could possibly make a run at one of these festivals as well.
Yeah, the fact that Netflix is going all in with Glass Onion at TIFF, I think shows that they'll be back in force in festival season again this year.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Well, let's go to movies that you can see now anywhere that you want to. Right now, you can go see Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris. Like I said, David talked to Leslie Manville on this podcast last week, but we didn't really get into the movie itself. And I haven't seen it yet, but I kind of like want to save it as a treat for myself when I want air conditioning and a nice summertime escape. Richard, it sounds like that really is the vibe.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It lives up to its title. Mrs. Harris does, in fact, go to Paris.
Oh, thank God.
Yeah. Mrs. Harris, as the book series was called, as a sort of Cockney thing, but we in America can't process that. So it has to be Harris with the H. Yeah, you know, it's Leslie Manville who, you can listen to David's interview with her, but, you know, she was, I think she was kind of last in a big way in Let Him Go, the Kevin Costner, Diane Lane thriller, where she played this matriarch villain of a sort of murderous family. And that was a complete departure from her Phantom Thread role or her previous Mike Lee roles. So, and this is a new thing, you know, even still. So it's fun to see Leslie Manville, who's a great actor, getting international recognition, you know, long into a storied career. Anyway, she's so good in this. She plays a, you know, working class woman. She's a basically a housekeeper for various wealthy clients in London who just gets it in her head that after seeing a Dior dress at one of her clients' houses, she says, you know, I kind of want that. And she scrapes the money together here and there, some luck, some other things, and goes to Dior, the headquarters in Paris, and says, I want to get a dress made. And it's kind of about how she affects the company and the people who work there or sort of are in its orbit, how that all affects her. It's a very sweet, familiar kind of fish out of water story, but it's made, I think, fresh and fun because Leslie Manville at the center is just such an appealing performance.
Yeah, I wasn't sure I was in the mood for this. I don't know if it's just because everything is so such a bummer sometimes in when it comes to the news and stuff, but it turns out it was exactly what I needed. I found it so charming and obviously has this sort of open-hearted optimism that I just needed that like in my veins right now. And it's such an enjoyable watch. And I loved having a movie that ties everything up with a sweet little bow. And if you want that experience, this is the perfect movie for that. And it's also a movie where like they're all in Paris, but they're running into each other everywhere, which I find hilarious.
There's like 10 people who live in Paris.
Yeah. Which like, you know, those sweet sorts of movies are just the best. And Leslie is so, so good in it. And it's interesting because there's a scene in it where obviously there's a fashion show. I don't know if Richard, if this stood out to you, but the models are super diverse, which obviously they were not in the 1950s in a Dior runway show. And I thought that was an interesting sort of modern choice that they made with the film.
Yeah, yeah. No, I know what you mean. I mean, I think there were certain little tweaks to the movie. It's not an intensely realistic period piece, mm-hmm. I guess you could mm-hmm. say. And speaking of that fashion show, so Jenny Bevan, you know, the multi Oscar winning costume designer.
She won this year, right?
For Cruella, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She did the costumes, and you're thinking, okay, so what does that mean? Because these are Dior dresses, but I guess they're kind of recreations with some tweaks. But whatever they are, they look incredible, as satisfying as you'd want them to be. And so there's that aspect of the movie, too. It's really appreciating that kind of couture craft in a fun way. And I think also not in a way that feels like conspicuous consumption. You know, it's not really a movie that's like, if you spend this much money on one item of clothing, you're going to feel good about your life. It's more about like, sometimes just shake up the routine, do something new, accept a loss and move forward or whatever. And the dress in that case is just a metaphor for whatever else, a cooking class or going on a new date or whatever. And I think in that way, it avoids a sort of consumerist bent that it maybe looked like it had from just the trailers.
You know, between this, Top Gun, which we'll talk about, Elvis, and then Where the Crawdads Sing, which we're getting to, like the adult-focused movies of the summer have been pretty remarkable. Thor is still dominating the box office, but I feel like it's not really the story of the summer, nor Jurassic World. It's like movies that adults actually want to leave the house to go see. As grown-ups, are we just proud of reclaiming this? Is this where we all become proudly middle-aged and put in our lot with the Mrs. Harris's of the world?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, why not?
I mean, going to see Mrs. Harris, and even Crawdads, which I didn't love, but like at its best, Crawdads has that glimmer of like a movie you might have seen in the 90s, you know, mm-hmm. nice glossy literary adaptation set in the South, like very Fried Green Tomatoes, very, you know, other things like that. And it felt good because what have I been seeing for work on the big screen for the past 6 weeks, 8 weeks is the Jurassics and the Thors and the what else, you know, whatever else is. I didn't see that. I'll confess. I've never seen a second of a Minion. I don't know anything about them.
You just encounter them everywhere in pop culture.
I mean, I know intimately what they are, but But yeah, so I think, you know, Mrs. Harris, I don't know how that's done. I kind of wish they had waited to release that not the same week as Crawdads, because
yeah.
Crawdads did pretty well. It made like, what, $17 million?
Yeah.
Which is significant for a $24 million movie.
Yep.
And I just wish that, like, okay, just wait a couple more weeks and then have Mrs. Harris be the counter-programming to Bullet Train or whatever, you know?
Yeah, have all of August yourself.
I think Harris will be a very, like, platformy, steady release. So I don't even think it's available to many people yet. But,
yeah, it opened in 980 theaters.
Oh, so
Crawdads
actually
Crawdads was in 3,600, though, so there's room to
okay.
grow.
Well, that's bigger than I thought, I guess, for
yeah.
Harris. But, you know, so go see it so you can, you know, somehow communicate to the powers that be that, like, this stuff actually has an audience that's worth, you know, that's willing to go out to the theaters for it.
Yeah, I do want to ask you about Crawdads, Richard, because you reviewed that as well. Did not seem to enjoy it as much as Mrs. Harris. Did you read the book, actually?
No, I did not.
Mm-mm. Okay, Rebecca, have you read that book?
I have read the book.
Okay, yeah, same. I didn't love the book either, so I feel like my guess is that the movie is just the book, which, like, as you sit down, you're like, wait, this is what this story is about? But I'm curious about how you feel like it is as, you know, a star thing for Daisy Edgar-Jones and then Reese Witherspoon's power as a producer. Like, I feel like she's been such a vivid, she's not in the movie, but she's, like, such a presence behind it. This is a pretty good feather in her cap, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's big. You know, it's one of the best-selling novels of all time. And
wow.
She had something to do with that because it was in her book club, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, having the rights and getting the movie made, and there are a lot of women behind the camera in a cool way. And, yeah, on paper, it's great. I think that in practice, it falls prey to the pitfalls are not avoided of many literary adaptations, which is that, like, they just are like, this is the story, then this happens, then this happens, then this happens, and now the movie's over. And you're just like,
yeah.
There needs to be some texture here. There needs to be, you know, because I've read snippets of the book, and it's like, yeah, there is some elegant, flowery, internal writing here, observation, you know, like interior monologue kind of stuff. And, like, you need to find a way not to recreate that literally on the screen, but to supplement that loss with something else cinematic, and the director just doesn't figure that out. And I think also another problem is, like, Daisy Edgar-Jones, and maybe it's the character and not so much the actor, but you're like, this doesn't really make any sense at all. You know, not to be whatever, but, like, we're talking about the British daughter of, like, the head of Sky Entertainment, like, playing an American foundling recluse in the swamps of North Carolina. And it's like, this just doesn't sync up. You know, I don't know where she had an access point to this character. And I don't think the script really gives her one anyway. So I think those two things combined, it's a weak adaptation script-wise, and the performance doesn't really sync up with the role. Those two things kind of sank it for me. And then, of course, there's the resurfaced stuff about Delia Owens herself and her past in Zambia with her husband and stepson and their efforts to be anti-poaching that might have led to a very, like, extrajudicial murder, kind of tainting one's perception of this world that she's built that feels very specifically drawn on particular race lines in a way that I think has obviously rankled some people ever since the book came out.
Yeah, I wondered if the movie eased up on that, because there's, like, really just a couple of significant black characters in the book, and they play very helpful supporting roles to the white characters and otherwise have nothing going on. And I wondered if the movie would adjust that at all.
Not really, no.
Oh, great. Okay.
I mean, just give me the movie about a writer who is wanted for murder and then writes a book about a woman who is wanted. I mean, just give it to me. Just do it.
Who's also something of a conservationist.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I joked to a friend.
That's the movie I want to see.
Afterward. And I was being, this is hyperbole, I'm not saying anything about Delia Owens' guilt or whatever, but I just said to my friend who I brought to the screening, I was like, she might as well have called that If I Did It. Like, it's like so close to home when you actually look into it. You're like, oh my God. But yeah, I just think it was inevitable that New Yorker piece and Salon piece
Slate.
It was inevitably going to happen when the movie was being released, because it was kind of a, you know, they did a good job of marketing and it was a buzzy release. And I read the New Yorker piece before seeing the movie, and yeah, it does put a weird gloss on the whole thing, or gloss is probably not the word, stain maybe. And I don't think that is the movie's main problem. You can separate that from the text of the movie. I think the text of the movie is just kind of weak, and it just feels very perfunctory in terms of adaptation.
I wonder how much the people who are like coming out to see this movie, I mean, it made $17 million, like you said, like, I wonder how much that's coming through, or if the people who care about this are the people like us who are just like, ah, like, I haven't been able to tell how much of it's part of the narrative for the people who actually went to see the movie or loved the book.
Well, I mean, Delia Owens' name got huge, hearty applause at the premiere that I went to. So,
wow.
I don't think it's permeated that much. And even if it has, I think people are like, it was her husband. It was 30 years ago, whatever. Which, like, I can understand that compartmentalization, but people seemed very into Delia Owens at the premiere. She wasn't there, but, you know,
she is who sold this book. She's who sold this movie in some way, I guess, in addition to...
Oh, yeah, I think so, because I think that the intended audience for this might have seen Normal People, but maybe that show skewed a bit younger. So I don't think that Daisy Edgar Jones is really a draw. Mm. It's not a terribly starry cast, you know, Harris Dickinson... Michael Hyatt, who plays one of the sort of people, like adults kind of over, you know, caretaking for the lead character, she's been around forever, and she's a great undersung actress. So it's fun to see her in something like this big, but her role as one half of this very kindly couple that's not fleshed out beyond that is a bit disappointing.
I am curious to see about Reese Witherspoon, powerhouse producer, where she's headed from here. She's got like some other book adaptations in the works. She's adapting the book that Dolly Parton wrote with James Patterson. Sure. But I do think that like her strength only seems to be growing from here, which is impressive.
Yeah, she's such a force to be reckoned with, especially when it comes to book to film. I think she just does amazing stuff in that genre.
Well, going back to the box office for a minute, we don't really talk about that much around here, but you kind of can't avoid reading about Top Gun Maverick at this point. Like, it is such a crazy phenomenon on the level which we certainly haven't seen since before COVID, and it's been a long while since then. It's made $618 million domestic and it was the number four at the box office this past week in its eighth week of release, which just does not happen anymore. And when we talked about it from Cannes with you guys, I think we were all seeing people being like, Tom Cruise is going to win Best Actor for Top Gun. And we were like, all right, come on, guys. But I'm kind of convincing myself that this is a possibility. And like, we've also got Austin Butler out there who we've talked about. Like, I think if two Best Actor nominees are from summer releases, like that would be really weird. But I can't dismiss the idea that Top Gun is such a phenomenon and Tom Cruise is so the center of it that some kind of like career Oscar nomination or win could be possible. Do you guys want to tell me that I'm crazy?
I think you're crazy.
Thank you. I needed someone to snap me out of it.
I mean, I know it's hard because it's true. It's like you read about Tom Cruise every day right now for 8 weeks, and it feels like that. And you know, he has had this career that I do think people might want to give that sort of tribute to. But every year there's box office movies that are huge, huge hits, and then they're not an awards thing at all. So obviously I just feel like that's eventually going to fall into this, even if the landscape is very different now than it has been, because we are still doing this whole saved theatrical releases narrative for this film. So
yeah,
to me, I would love to see them try. I would find that very interesting and would be very excited to talk about it all season, but I don't see it happening.
That's not a bad reason to launch a campaign. If people want, if like, it gives people something to talk about and they want to talk about it, like, there are campaigns built on worse or less.
Yeah. But last year there was even a conversation of, like, Spider-Man saved the box office. Let's give it some Oscars. And that never obviously came to fruition. So.
That conversation seemed to annoy people more than Top Gun speculation does, you know? Because I think Top Gun is appealing more to a sort of, I guess Spider-Man did appeal to some nostalgia as well, but, like, this feels a little bit more... I mean, for better or for worse, like nostalgia for a lost era, a lost country. I don't know. You know, there's something bigger about this and less kind of corporately cynical. But my thing with Cruise after, you know, the movie started doing really well, because I don't know if listeners remember, I predicted this movie would bomb. So shows what I know.
but, you shouldn't have reminded them of that.
Well, I'm going to have to own up to this stuff, Katie. is that OK? Maybe he won't get any nominations or whatever for this, but if he wants a competitive acting Oscar, all he has to do is get one plum supporting role in some fall movie in 2023 or 2024, preferably next year, just like rush that into production, and he will win on a wave of goodwill. I think I think that's the way to do it. But I don't know if that's really what he cares about anymore. You know, I think he wants to make these big spectaculars that prop up the industry. He's good at doing that, kind of against all odds at times. So maybe that's kind of his new mission. But it's kind of like with J-Lo and Hustlers. It's like, stick with it. Do one more. And it, she doesn't seem to have chosen that option. She's gone back to rom-coms, got, you know, leaned heavily, more heavily into the music again.
Married Ben Affleck.
But, you know, I just think that if Tom Cruise wanted it, this is the time, is to book that role with some respected director, have it be a little category fraud. It's kind of a second lead, but you could run it in supporting Brad Pitt style and just walk away with it easily.
My argument of why this wouldn't follow the Spider-Man path is that Top Gun, it's IP, you know, it's a sequel to a movie, and I'm always really begging for a sequel to, but it's performance driven in a way that Spider-Man and in a way that most modern blockbusters aren't. Like, it is special as a blockbuster, you know, less so than Mad Max Fury Road, but I think it's very technically interesting, which we've talked about, but I think his charisma and his presence as like the guiding force of that movie is special and is something that, like, that's a different kind of nostalgia for blockbusters that were based on star persona and not franchise building. And I wonder if that would make a campaign for him specifically. Like, I think if you try to campaign Maverick for Best Picture, like, I think that's going to be a different thing. But I think, like, Tom Cruise, you are special. You are what made this savior of the box office possible. Like, it seems like the most logical Oscar nomination for this movie for me, if you're going to give it anything.
Other than Gaga.
Oh, yeah, obviously. And sound, probably. Yeah.
Oh, we also didn't mention, speaking of Gaga's competition, that Taylor Swift's original song for Crawdads is eligible. So here I was a couple of weeks ago thinking Gaga had already won that Oscar. And now it's like, oh, I don't know. Taylor Swift is in the mix now, too.
I feel like every year we get ourselves really excited for a starry original song category, and it just goes in weird directions instead.
So. Right. They're like, here's this power ballad from a movie no one saw.
the Diane Warren path. Yeah. And now she's getting her honorary. Yeah, I mean, I don't want to be the one beating the drum for Tom Cruise, because, like, I think when you have the ability to stump for awards stuff, which we do to some degree, like, you want to pick smaller stuff that needs more attention. But, like, I see the case for Maverick in a way I didn't, you know, when it was just a hit, not like a massive industry rescuing hit. And I'm curious if other people will start thinking the same way.
It does seem to have turned some kind of corner on that front. Because I think part of it is that it's we're still talking about it, and it came out in Hollywood terms like ages ago.
Yeah.
Or new Hollywood terms. I mean, it's funny. I just did an episode of another podcast about an old movie, and it's like, you just remember that, like, in the mid-century of last century, like, movies were just, like, in theaters for years. You know, like, they would leave for a bit and come back and whatever. So we have a much shorter attention span these days. And the fact that Top Gun is still making money, still being spoken about, it seems to kind of take on new facets every week or two, and I think that could mean something. You know, I don't think you're quite crazy, Katie. I think it's still a long shot.
Sure.
I also think he would probably have to campaign, and I am curious what, you know, Tom Cruise leads a very controlled life, I think, when it comes to his public appearances and things like that, and press especially. So I think maybe he can just have a campaign based on his name and legacy alone, but I feel like he would have to actually pound the pavement a little bit.
I mean, we do have a very recent example of a megastar kind of freaking out a little bit to campaign for an Oscar, which is Will Smith, which went really well until it didn't. And I think Tom Cruise would not be likely to have a public outburst, but I would have said the same thing for Will Smith.
Where I could see Tom Cruise winning a significant award for this movie, I think it could be the Producers Guild Awards.
Oh, interesting.
Because what a feat to have wrestled this thing back into life 30 plus years later, to have the movie sit on a shelf during COVID and then basically be the first thing, well, second thing after Spider-Man, or however you want to put these. One of the things that, like, brought audiences back to theaters, older audiences too. Maybe that feat, you know, with him and Bruckheimer and everybody else, would be enough to get him a prize for that. That would be interesting.
So would you guys put more money on Austin Butler at this point being an Oscar nominee than Tom Cruise?
Yeah, I guess, I think so. But I feel like that movie kind of came and went in a way.
Fizzled, I mean, it's still making money too. Like, it was number 5 at the box office this past week. It's cracked $100 million domestically.
Which is significant. I mean, that is good for that movie. But I don't see people talking about it in the same way. But maybe that's just because of who
I'm
talking
to. Yeah, it's not quite the same level of phenomenon. But the way that Baz Luhrmann keeps making movies, everyone's like, this has got to be it, right? Like, no one's going to go see this. And he's like, nope, made $100 million. Bye. Like, he's just...
Yeah.
He's got something that works. Okay, so we'll return to Emmys briefly. We do want to keep hearing your Emmy questions and text us and tweet at us or whatever else. And, of course, we'll be talking about categories more going forward. But I did get a question from Paul in subtext who wanted to ask about Hannah Einbinder being a continuing place in supporting for Hacks and then had a sidebar, which is that the three guest actors nominations for Hacks, Laurie Metcalf, Harriet Sampson Harris and Jane Addams were all guest stars on Frasier, which Jean Smart won 2 Emmys for in the guest actress role.
Wow.
I mean, I think the category fraud thing for Hannah Einbinder, kind of we had that conversation back when back last season when Hacks first happened. But do you see it continuing to be a problem for a show like this that, like, once she's in there, she's category frauded and she's just going to get overlooked? Like, is there ever ability to change something like this, or does anyone even care other than awards nerds like us?
I just think that category is so competitive that obviously we all understand
the lead actress category, you mean?
Well, the supporting for Hannah. You're asking if Hannah could ever win in the supporting category.
Yeah.
Or this listener is asking that. I don't think it's because people, you know, are turned off by the fact that she should be lead, but they don't want to put her against Jean Smart and all of that. I just think this category is really, really hard, and it wouldn't matter. That whole thing wouldn't matter because, I mean, you look at this list of, how many is it this year? Eight women? You know, I mean, that's already sort of insane. And there's a lot of splits between shows and everything that, to me, it just feels like they're always going to give Jean Smart the win, you know what I mean? And the love. And then in the supporting, it's just not a lock for Hannah ever.
I also think that putting Hannah in supporting and Jean Smart in lead is just meta commentary on the show. You're never going to be the star, baby. It's always me. And I think that probably both sides are like fine with that. But I think increasingly, you know, on TV especially, it feels like these categories don't always make sense because so many shows are ensemble and, you know, it's not like a movie where there's some shows obviously have a lead or two leads or whatever, but like a lot of TV these days is not quite built that way. And so sometimes these categories just feel sort of arbitrary.
Yeah, I was talking to a friend of mine about Steve Martin and Martin Short both being nominated as lead actors in Only Murders in the Building, which is fascinating, especially because Selena Gomez doesn't get nominated as an actress, but they both got in there. And it's actually been a long time since two actors were nominated as co-leads in a comedy like this, which I thought was an interesting way that like these rules all seem set in stone until the right thing comes along and they can break it.
Yeah, you think about the Friends cast famously always went supporting, you know, as like a sign of like unity or whatever. And only, I think, two of them won. And like Sex and the City would like do, like SJP was lead, right? And then and that made sort of some sense. But yeah, I think it's just a real case-by-case basis. And I think the weird thing with Hacks is that I think it's easier to make the argument that Hannah Einbinder's the lead and Jean Smart's the supporting character because we're kind of entering this world through Hannah's eyes.
Yeah.
But, oh well.
I was looking at that supporting actress category that Hannah Einbinder is in, and I think it is one of the more sneakily competitive ones we've got. I think we talked about this last week, but you've got Hannah Waddingham, who won last year kind of in a walk, but I feel like the competition is a lot more interesting this year. Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, Hacks, Abbott Elementary, Saturday Night Live, Ted Lasso are all represented in there, and I don't know. I don't know who I would put my money on at this point. It will be an interesting one to watch and see if a winner becomes clear in the coming months.
I think it'd be cool for Cheryl Ralph.
Yeah.
She's in that category, right? Yep.
Yeah.
I think that would be kind of neat and, you know, kind of a not career capping. Her career's still got lots of time left in it. But I just mean like, you know, it's been a long time since Dreamgirls. And she's been very vocal about how this show is the best thing she's done since Dreamgirls. Maybe people in the industry are paying attention to that.
It's also her first Emmy nomination. And it's her career is so phenomenal, and I totally agree with you, Richard. It would be nice to see her get that win. And I don't know. I think it feels like we just have to kind of wait and see how much the Ted Lasso phenomenon continues or, you know, if there is room for others this year, especially in that category.
I was realizing that this time last year, when the Emmy nominations came out, Ted Lasso season 2 was airing, and they're not airing it right now. I don't know when season 3 is supposed to come back, but, you know, I think that show would have really succeeded regardless, but that was a real benefit to it. And now it's only Murders in the Building that's trying that out, and I'm curious about how that will play out. About Shirley Ralph, though, I love what Quinta Brunson said to you, Rebecca, in the interview episode that aired earlier this week about how she had told Shirley Ralph, like, I am going to give you Emmy-worthy material. And then it panned out.
I know.
She saw the future in some way.
I love that she said that because no one ever admits that they think about things like that.
You know, when
they're part of the race. But it is true, too. I do really think she held up on that promise.
And I feel like anytime you watch, like, you know, a behind the scenes show, like, I think even Barry might have had this, where, like, people are in production on something being like, you'll get an Emmy for this. Like, it seems like people do it a lot and then just never admit it. So good for you for being honest, Quinta Brunson.
A good time to rewatch for your consideration, though. Just keep that in mind.
doesn't it make you feel dirty for obsessing over this as much as we do?
Well, I don't know. But I think that movie obviously is such an overstatement. I've always wondered, what happened to Christopher Guest awards-wise to make him make that movie? You know, was there something, or he got that bug in his ear? Someone told him that, oh, Best in Show is going to win something? I don't know. It's just very, very strange to me. But
yeah, or like someone he knows, like, went through it. I'd be...
Yeah, yeah.
I wonder what Jamie Lee Curtis has to say about awards buzz.
Yeah, exactly.
We should maybe do a rewatch of that sometime. That'd be fun to talk about on this show. All right, put it down. That does it for this week's show. As we said, we'll be doing a book club in August, talking about books that will be adapted into films that, as far as we know, are coming out this fall. We'll be talking about Women Talking, a novel being adapted by Sarah Polley. She Said, the book written by Jodi Kantor and Megan Twohey about their Harvey Weinstein investigation. Bones and All, a novel being adapted by Luca Guadagnino. And then Killers of the Flower Moon, the nonfiction book that Martin Scorsese is adapting later this year. Go check them out from the library. Buy the books. Read along with us. It's going to be a really fun month. In the meantime, you can find us at vanityfair.com. You can find us on Twitter at Little Gold Men, and on our own, I am at Katie Rich and Richard.
Rylaws.
And Rebecca.
Becca M. Ford.
You can also sign up to text with us at joinsubtext.com/littlegoldmen or text 213-513-7180. Our editor and producer is Brett Fuchs, and this week's award for the best reason that David Canfield missed this week's show goes to me. Married Ben Affleck.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness, really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.